Support for The World's Podcast comes from LegalZoom. With over 17 years and more than 2 million customers, LegalZoom provides helpful support, legal advice, and transparency for business owners. More information at LegalZoom.com/world.
Friday Night Special, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Special counsel Robert Mueller ends months of speculation and delivers his report on links between the Trump campaign and Russia into the hands of the Attorney General. What we know and what we'll soon know, coming up. Also this hour, a German museum cringes over its Michael Jackson exhibit.
We are shocked here at Bundeskanzler. I feel shocked. I feel uncomfortable.
But the show goes on. Plus, 1 week after the attack on two mosques in Christchurch, this New Zealander reflects on what's changed in her country.
I think the way New Zealand has embraced Islam and adopted Islamic traditions this week has been something that is really remarkable.
Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. The day has finally arrived. Special Counsel Robert Mueller today delivered his report to the Attorney General. This marks the end of an investigation that started 2 years ago.
I have been authorized by the Department of Justice to confirm that the FBI, as part of our counterintelligence mission, is investigating the Russian government's efforts to interfere in the 2016 presidential election.
That's former FBI Director James Comey speaking in March of 2017. Of course, Comey would later be fired by President Trump, and Robert Mueller would be appointed to lead that investigation into links between the Trump campaign and Russia. What a 2 years it's been since then. Joining me in the studio is The World's Matthew Bell, has been covering the story for us. And also with us on the line is journalist Garrett Graff. He's the author of a biography of Robert Mueller. Matthew Bell, you've been here. You've been watching this since the beginning. What just happened?
Yeah, it was soon after 5 o'clock. We just got news that a statement had come out from the Attorney General's office. William Barr said that the investigation from the special counsel led by Robert Mueller had concluded. That means we know certain things. We know the investigation is now over. It's been, as you said, been going on for so long, produced a lot of material. But there's a lot of unanswered questions. There's a whole lot that we don't know, and especially what comes next.
I mean, it is a little awkward to talk about a report we haven't seen. The report is said to be comprehensive. That's the word that's been bandied about. What could comprehensive mean?
Right. The first thing is, how are we going to find out and when are we going to find out? That's a huge question, is how the DOJ, the Department of Justice, will transfer this information over to Congress. How will this be handled? How much of it will go public? In some ways, legally, we're going to have to learn certain things. So some questions will be answered, and then there will still be unknowns at that point.
Let me put that same question to Garrett Graff, who is with us now. The report is said to be comprehensive, Garrett. What could comprehensive mean, do you think?
Well, there are a number of different things that this could mean for us at this point. One is, this could just be a narrative of what Mueller has found, piecing together sort of the existing hundreds of pages of documents he has already turned over, and added to it as well sort of information more directly relating to the president. Because remember, one of the things that is standing Justice Department policy is that the president himself cannot be indicted. And so this whole aspect of Bob Mueller's investigation that's supposed to be looking at the obstruction of justice question and whether the president obstructed justice through the firing of FBI Director Jim Comey or through other actions over the last couple of years, presumably Mueller was never going to bring charges against Donald Trump directly and instead was going to be turning over that information to the Attorney General to turn over to Congress.
You know, just to go back and review how much has already happened. I mean, the Trump-Russia story precedes the inauguration in 2017. It's really into its third year now. Here's just a taste of what we've all been through since the story started.
Former Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort and his business associate Rick Gates have been indicted by a federal grand jury on a number of felony charges, including money laundering and conspiracy against the United States.
He was candidate Trump's and then President Trump's main advisor on national security and foreign policy. But today, Michael Flynn entered a guilty plea in the special counsel's investigation.
The FBI raided the office of President Trump's longtime personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, marks the confluence of two scandals for President Trump. Robert Mueller's investigation into Russian election meddling, and the ongoing controversy surrounding Cohen's $130,000 payment to adult film actress Stormy Daniels.
Well, so many names, so much time. Incredible.
Garrett, Matthew Bell here. When you think about that long record of what the Mueller team has done already, what jumps out at you at this point? I want to know more, of course, about what you expect to come out of the final report. But, you know, there's hundreds of pages of indictments. There's a lot we've already learned. There sort of is, in some ways, a Mueller report already.
Exactly. And I think that that's one of the things that a lot of people have sort of skipped over as we have all been awaiting this big final report, is that Bob Mueller has already done two very big things. First is he has already conducted one of the most important counterintelligence investigations in American history. His probe and charges that he has already brought against the Russian GRU military intelligence officers and the Internet Research Agency Facebook bots and trolls that attacked the 2016 election, that will stand in history as one of the most important espionage cases and counterintelligence cases that the U.S. has ever seen, right up there with the Rosenbergs or Aldrich Ames or Robert Hansen. The second thing, and you know, you were just sort of going through some of the sound from this, is he has already shown that the Trump campaign was the most criminal political enterprise that U.S. politics has ever seen. That this was a campaign where almost every senior official on the campaign was involved in extensive federal felonies, largely unrelated to the campaign itself, which is sort of stunning. You know, you have the campaign chairman involved in this Russian-Ukrainian money laundering scheme. You have the Trump's lawyer, Michael Cohen, involved in this multi-year tax bank and taxi medallion fraud. You have the National Security Advisor working on behalf of the government of Turkey, Michael Flynn. The deputy campaign chairman wrapped up in this, also for lower level aides like George Papadopoulos as well.
It's really widespread, isn't it, Garrett?
It is. And it's the type of thing that, like, under normal circumstances, that alone would be politically damaging enough.
We're going to have to leave it there. Journalist Garrett Graff, thank you very much. And The World's Matthew Bell, thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
What to do with former ISIS fighters? That's a problem facing many countries like Russia. Thousands of Russians left to join ISIS, mostly from Dagestan, a majority Muslim republic in the Caucasus Mountains. And in the case we're about to hear, a couple took their Russian-born children with them to Iraq. That was 4 years ago. Samira is now 9 years old. Her brother Abu Bakr is just five. The father was killed in an airstrike in Iraq. The mother was later captured. And the children spent almost 2 years locked in a cell with her. In December, Samira and Abu Bakr were returned to Dagestan to live with their aunt, and that's where my BBC colleague Sarah Rainsford caught up with them.
First of all, they were tearing around their backyard of their house on two brand new bikes that they'd been given. They were basically, I think, learning to be children again. They were also trying to catch up on their education. Samira, the little girl, she didn't go to school in the Islamic State. She just got some kind of religious education there. She learned a bit of Arabic, but she's got a lot of catching up to do to catch up with her peers at school. And little Abu Bakr was just literally playing like crazy, crashing his bike into his sister's bike, smiling, laughing. Apparently, according to his aunt, he's finding it much easier to adjust, but Samira does still have nightmares and still remembers what happened to her in Iraq as a nightmare.
Here's what her aunt Malika told you about how hard it is for Samira to think back to those days.
I think she is trying to forget. One time she remembered something, and I said, "Forget it, it's all a nightmare." And she said, "It was a very long nightmare, very long."
Where are Abu Bakr and Samira's mother today?
Their mother's still in prison in Iraq. And in fact, she's one of several dozen Russian women who were wives of ISIS fighters captured in Iraq, mostly after the fall of Mosul. And they were sentenced in trials in Iraq to life in prison, which actually means about 20 years. So as I say, talking to her sister, Malika, she was really hoping that Russian officials can negotiate and can intercede to bring those women home to serve out their sentences or to live back with their families here in Russia. I think that's something at the moment of a distant hope. But certainly talking about her sister, she was saying, you know, she was tricked. She didn't know where she was going, as you hear an awful lot from relatives talking on this topic, suggesting that her sister really didn't know what she was getting into when she went there with her husband.
And how are they coping without their mother? Or is it really what those two kids saw in the Islamic State that seems to haunt them more right now?
I think it's a mixture of both. I mean, they are missing their mum. Of course they are. They didn't enjoy being in prison. Their auntie told me that they came back covered in bites and fleas, that they hadn't been eating properly for a long time. But they missed terribly being able to speak to their mum. And their sort of big hope is that she will come back to them. There is another element in all of this, which is that there is a baby brother involved, a little boy called Zubair, who's 2 years old, and he's still with his mother in the Baghdadi prison, the Iraqi prison. There are efforts underway right now to get him brought to Russia, but that was a bit more complicated because he was actually born in Iraq. But he is expected to be brought back on a flight in the next couple of months.
Sarah Rainsford, how did Samira's aunt Malika manage to get this little girl and her brother out of Iraq?
Well, she wasn't on her own. She, in fact, told me there was around about 250 women, mainly people in a group of relatives who were imploring the authorities here in Russia to intercede on their behalf. So it all went through diplomatic channels, through government channels in the end. But they were literally sort of running around every bureaucrat's office that they could find, anyone who they thought could help them. So certainly I spoke to the children's ombudswoman in Dagestan, and she told me that right now, even now, on her desk, she has a appeals from 700 families to try to find relatives who are in Syria and Iraq, all of them with different stories. But she also said, you know, that's 700. But in each one of those appeals, she said there are multiple children, 4 or 5 children involved. So I think, you know, whilst many countries are wrestling with this very issue right now, what to do about the wives, the children, and of course, even the fighters, those who've survived, I think in Russia, the scale is quite extraordinary. We are talking certainly about hundreds, potentially thousands of people, which Russia needs to decide exactly what it's going to do with.
You met a young Russian woman named Victoria, who ran away to join ISIS with 2 friends that she met working at McDonald's. She managed to return home to her village and is serving a 5-year suspended sentence. Here's what she told you.
I didn't kill anyone. I'm clean. Before God and the authorities, I didn't kill. I won't answer for others. Everyone must answer for their own sins.
How are people in Russia accepting these returnees?
Well, I think perhaps the simplest answer to that is to point to the fact that the women are no longer being returned. Since the FSB security chief made a statement saying that he believed that these women were a threat to the security of Russia, quietly, the return of women has basically been shelved, and it's just the children who are being brought back now. At least that's the main focus. It is extremely complicated. Meeting Victoria, the woman you just heard from, was quite a sort of disconcerting experience for me. I expected her to be fairly forthright in expressing regret and condemnations. But, you know, she was adamant that she hadn't fought and therefore she wasn't guilty as such. She certainly wasn't coming out and saying that she'd made the wrong choice and that IS was wrong. She was trying to justify her decision. She said that she couldn't regret it because she actually had 2 children when she lived over there, so she couldn't regret that. And also she said, you know, there was fighting and killing on both sides. I asked her about terrorist attacks specifically. She said killing was wrong, but she wouldn't come out directly, really, and condemn IS as a terrorist organization. Which I did find quite extraordinary, given that she's back here in Russia now.
The BBC Moscow correspondent Sarah Rainsford speaking with us about efforts to bring the children of ISIS recruits back home to Russia. Sarah, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The name Sackler makes a lot of people angry these days. The Sacklers are the family that's made billions from sales of the painkiller OxyContin. The drug is a chief villain in the opioid epidemic, but the Sacklers are also major philanthropists who've given generously to institutions around the globe. Those institutions are under intense pressure to reject the family's money. Now, 2 have, both in Britain, the National Portrait Gallery in London and the Tate Galleries. Benjamin Soskas focuses on philanthropy at the Urban Institute in Washington. So how big of a deal are these announcements by the Tate and National Portrait Galleries in London, Ben?
I think they're a pretty big deal. for all the controversy that surrounded the Sackler family over the last couple of years, there hasn't been a single cultural or educational institution, at least that I'm aware of, that has explicitly said they were going to not accept any more Sackler money, and puts a lot of pressure on other institutions to make similar decisions.
Yeah, and there's been tons of pressure on American cultural institutions and universities to cut ties with the Sacklers. Why do you think it was European institutions who came to this decision first?
There's two possible explanations. One is the nature of decision-making in these cultural institutions there, which is slightly different than in the American context. Perhaps the deeper question is whether or not American institutions all feel like they are in competition for Sackler money. Anyone who opts out is putting themselves at a major disadvantage, and the pursuit of high sums in these institutions is fierce. And so I think there was a general reluctance not to be the first. Now, however, the pressure really is on.
So let's get down to the brass tacks. Just how important are the Sacklers as philanthropists?
They are one of the major philanthropic families of the late 20th and early 21st century with a real global reach. They have a major presence in British institutions, but they've also funded the Louvre, Peking University. They've funded a Jewish museum in Germany. Their reach extends extremely far. And in the U.S., they have funded hundreds of millions of dollars through some of the major, major research institutions in the country.
Yeah, the other thing is that the Sackler family is vast. How big and sprawling is this family?
Well, so there were three patriarchs that took a small pharmaceutical company that was known generally for making laxatives and transformed it into a pharmaceutical giant, in part through OxyContin. One of them died before the advent of OxyContin, Arthur Sackler. That leaves two patriarchs, Richard and Mortimer, and they were the ones who helped build the company through OxyContin. So when you see the Sackler name on a museum's wall, you can't automatically assume that the money came from the sale of this problematic opioid. And that's one reason why, say, the Metropolitan Museum in New York has emphasized the fact that the money they received was from Arthur, who did not have his hand in OxyContin.
I mean, some critics would say that the philanthropic side of the Sackler family basically allowed them to continue profiting from a killer drug while garnering goodwill and cover through museums and galleries. Do you think that's fair?
It's unclear to me the extent to which their philanthropic profile shielded them from public scrutiny. I think they just had very good lawyers and to some extent were able to hide behind the kind of corporation itself. If they really wanted to avoid scrutiny, they could have had a much lower profile, both philanthropically and otherwise. The problem is they wanted it both ways. They wanted to avoid any type of acknowledgement of their role in Purdue Pharma, but they wanted to have a major public profile as philanthropists. And I think what's happened is that that contradiction just became too severe and it sort of fell apart.
Benjamin Soskus with the Urban Institute in Washington, where he focuses on philanthropy. Thanks very much for telling us about the Sackler family.
My pleasure.
Last year, that same National Portrait Gallery in London we were just talking about put together an exhibit called Michael Jackson on the Wall. It looks at the late pop singer as a cultural phenomenon. The exhibit has since been shown in Paris, and it was getting ready to open in Germany when HBO aired this.
He was one of the kindest people I knew, and he also sexually abused me.
I was seven years old. We had this.
In the two-part documentary Leaving Neverland, two men detail allegations of child sex abuse against a singer, abuse they experienced. Many institutions have since distanced themselves from Michael Jackson and his music, but the Bundeskunsthalle in Bonn, Germany, is moving forward with its exhibit. Michael Jackson on the Wall opened to the public there today. Ryan Wolfs is the museum's director.
We go forward with the exhibit because it's not an exhibition in which we are showing pieces by Michael Jackson. It's an art exhibition. It's an exhibition with artworks with about 50 artists from different corners of the world who are reacting on the phenomenon Michael Jackson. And we have the feeling that it is necessary to show cultural history and not to erase cultural history, because otherwise our cultural history is not the same anymore.
Do you feel it is a balanced exhibition? Like, are any of those artistic reflections on Jackson kind of addressing the disturbing allegations that course through his life or that have passed through the last 30 years?
If they are doing this, it's more like hidden. There is, for instance, a video by an American artist, Jordan Wolfson, who is showing this TV interview from the 90s where Michael Jackson was defending Neverland against the allegations. And Jordan Wolfson takes this video piece, erases the original audio, so you don't hear Michael Jackson defending Neverland, but you only hear a bit of water running every now and then and nothing else. So he is making something completely different out of this defensive interview of Michael Jackson.
So the exhibition at the Bundeskristalle was scheduled to go up before these new accusations of child sex abuse came out. What was going through your mind when the documentary was released? Did it catch you off guard? Did you watch it?
I watched it. We are shocked here at Bundeskristalle. I feel shocked. I feel uncomfortable with the documentary, of course, very much. We take the documentary as a document very serious, and we are finding a language, we are finding a subtext around the exhibition to make people aware of the different situation we're living in today after this documentary came out.
Did you make changes to the exhibition after these new allegations came out, or have any artists asked for their work to be pulled from the exhibition?
No artist asked for taking out the works of the exhibition. We did some textual changes, and we did some changes in terms of we put a statement at the beginning of the exhibition, and we have a person who is the whole day in the exhibition and is speaking with people about what's happening. And this person is also giving people guidelines to have more different views on the artworks which are being on show, so that in some artworks you are looking at them differently after Leaving Neverland came out.
Ryan Wolfs, the director of the Bundeskunsthalle Museum in Bonn, Germany, an art exhibit on the legacy of Michael Jackson opened there today. Ryan Wolfs, thanks very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
I'm Marco Werman. Special Counsel Robert Mueller has delivered his report, and while we still have a lot of questions, this much is clear.
He has already conducted one of the most important counterintelligence investigations in American history.
What that tells us about Russia, Trump, and everything else, still ahead here on The World. Two years after the start of the investigation, it is over. Special Counsel Robert Mueller has concluded his investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election and related matters. That is how Attorney General William Barr put it in a statement this afternoon. And this is how President Trump previewed this moment just a couple of days ago.
Let it come out. Let people see it. That's up to the Attorney General. We have a very good Attorney General. He's a very highly respected man. And we'll see what happens. But it's sort of interesting that a man out of the blue just writes a report. I got 306 electoral votes against 223. That's a tremendous victory.
It has been quite a ride these past 2 years. I'm joined now by Seth Hetena, investigative reporter and author of Trump Russia, A Definitive History. Seth, your reaction to the news?
Well, frankly, I'm surprised the report came out when it did, because as I see it, there are still some loose ends here. There are still witnesses like Rick Gates, Manafort's right-hand man, who's still cooperating with ongoing investigations. There's a mystery company out there that is being subpoenaed by Mueller's team, a foreign company that we don't even know the name of yet. And some of Roger Stone's associates are fighting off subpoenas. So there's a lot of loose ends, but I guess, you know, we're here, so we have to try to figure out what we can from what we know.
Yeah, and what do those loose ends and those characters you just mentioned, what kind of big unknowns do they all kind of point to that you hope this report is going to answer?
Well, you know, that's the million-dollar question. What is this report going to answer? You know, the obvious, you know, the question that Robert Mueller was assigned to find out is the thing we all want to know, which is, was there collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia during the election? You know, the Russian company, I should say the mystery company, which may be Russian or may not, but that may get us closer to that. But, you know, we're just kind of speculating here, so it's hard to say.
What would it take to prove collusion at this point?
Well, proving collusion is one thing. That's the tricky thing here is that, you know, Robert Mueller may have declined to prosecute people because he couldn't prove collusion. Now, that doesn't mean that, you know, that means there was insufficient evidence to establish that collusion existed. It doesn't mean it didn't happen. It just means he didn't have evidence of it. You know, what we've seen already is that the Russians were reaching deep into this political campaign at low levels, like George Papadopoulos, the so-called coffee boy, at higher levels through, you know, possibly through Paul Manafort, but through the NRA. At multiple levels, the Russians were trying to get in. And Don Jr. Famously at least showed a willingness to collude. So, you know, what I want to stress is that, you know, we're all breathlessly waiting for this report, but we shouldn't disregard what we already know about Trump and about Russia.
The indictments over the past 2 years have delivered a lot of information. I mean, are you expecting any surprises at this point?
I'm most interested in seeing what he had to say about who he declined to prosecute, you know, who was on that list of the declinations and what are the reasons for the declinations? You know, is Don Jr. on that list? Is Donald Trump on that list? That's the questions I want to see answered.
Yeah. And ultimately, the big question is whether the president committed any crimes. Will that be answered, do you think?
Well, you know, it may be. I hope it will. I think he's going to have to explain why he was, at the very least, why he was trying to interview the president. And you know what it's the response. The ball is now in Congress's hands. That if there was evidence that wasn't sufficient to prosecute, but there was evidence that that Trump did have some, you know, some strange dealings with the Russians, that Congress should has to take that ball and now run with it and take it wherever it leads.
Well, safe to say a lot of people are having awkward conversations tonight about a report that nobody's seen yet. Well, one person's seen. Can we just get a little bit philosophical? Because for you, Seth, the Russia-Trump timeline goes back not to 2016, but to 1989 in New York City. We've just got like half a minute here. Is this the beginning of the end or the end of the beginning?
I think it's the end of a long relationship that began in the 1980s and just deepened and developed over time. And, you know, began as apartment sales, moved into development deals for some of Trump's buildings, and then moved into his political campaign. So I see it as a long arc that is bending possibly towards Donald Trump's impeachment. We'll have to see.
Seth Hatena, investigative reporter and author of Trump Russia. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
Is an hour-long iPad training session enough for airline pilots to understand a complex software system? That's one of the questions being asked in the wake of two deadly crashes involving Boeing 737 MAX 8 planes. That system is called MCAS, and it's under scrutiny by investigators. David Learmount is a former pilot and aviation journalist in the UK. He says there are virtually no differences in the way pilots are trained in the UK and the US, but that after the first of those two crashes involving a Lion Air flight in Indonesia, there was a push in the U.S. to review the 737 manual.
The U.S. aviation world is like a very big family, and they talk to each other. And when suspicions started coming out of the Lion Air investigation, the American pilot started going back to the flight crew operations manual and looking for what might have gone wrong. The FAA.
So indeed, wait a minute. You're saying that some American pilots were not aware of this MCAS system.
That is absolutely correct. Yes. Although when the suspicions started coming in that there was something more they should know, they very quickly educated themselves with Boeing's help and the FAA's help. The rest of the world was rather slower to catch up.
So are you saying there were no accidents in the U.S. On American carriers due to luck?
Well, I don't know. I suppose you could put it that way. It is a possibility that if Lion Air had not, if the accident had not happened, that, you know, a Lion Air or an Ethiopian could have happened in America.
Well, it certainly wasn't clear to those poor pilots of Ethiopian Airlines and the Lion Air pilots who were scrambling through the manual as the plane is diving. Do you think the differences are even starker when you go to a place like Ethiopia or Indonesia? I mean, you suggested that really the differences in training are not that big between the UK and the US.
There are some sort of training philosophy differences, but they're rather more generic I'm not talking about differences which are specific to the 737 series or even the 737 MAX. I'm talking about a different attitude towards the way that that pilots become qualified.
Recent reports, though, show that it's not really attitudes of pilots in Ethiopia or Indonesia. It's that pilots were given the option to be trained on this anti-stall system. It was optional, not mandatory. How do you explain that?
The option is whether they had some additional equipment which would make it clearer that the MCAS was operating. The pilots up until now have just done some homework using information presented to them on an iPad, and they've had to go with that. So when something has happened in the 737 MAX, if they reacted to it exactly the same way, exactly as they had done in the 737 next generation, the previous generation, it would not have stopped the MCAS working. Now, fortunately, the American, the American family of pilots got their heads around this one before an event of that nature occurred. But in the rest of the world, and certainly we know for a fact in Indonesia, they had not done that.
Do you have a simple explanation why there is no parity between countries for flight training? Like, can the U.S. and the FAA open up their aviation family, as you put it?
They could, and there is a move to have aviation training standardized throughout the world. But every single country, and particularly the USA, has its own national pilot's license and its own national system for training. Everybody else has the same attitude. Europe has standardized within, 28 countries. But the USA will not have any of that. It has its own system, and these systems are different.
So in addition to the software fix of the anti-stall system, do you think Boeing ought to now insist that all pilots who climb into the cockpit of a 737 MAX to be trained on all aspects of operating the aircraft?
The problem is with the whole philosophy of common type ratings is that it has gone too far. The reason why the airlines and the manufacturers like them is because they save money. It's cheap to give somebody an iPad with some information on it and say, learn the differences and then go and fly the machine. Frankly, that isn't good enough.
It certainly seems like it's not good enough. David Learmount, former pilot and aviation journalist based in the UK. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Huge crowds are expected in Argentina tomorrow. There are anti-abortion rallies scheduled in cities around the country with the theme, Save Them Both, referring to the unborn child and the mother. As in a lot of Latin America, abortion is mostly illegal in Argentina. It is permitted only in cases of rape, incest, and when the mother's life is in danger. But activists in Argentina say even in those instances where it is legal, it's difficult to get an abortion. The World's Allison Herrera reports on one such case, and I should say this case has some disturbing details, as you're about to hear.
The case of an 11-year-old girl in Argentina who was raped by her grandmother's boyfriend was shocking enough. But when the girl, who's referred to as Lucia, complained to a doctor of stomach pains, it turned out she was pregnant.
Puede acceder a un aborto contemplado por la ley en estos casos.
Local news reports said Lucia and her family wanted an abortion. She was 16 weeks pregnant at the time, and in Lucia's case, it was legal. But several doctors reportedly refused. The provincial health minister intervened, claiming the girl and her family wanted the baby. Authorities stalled for weeks, and 11-year-old Lucia ultimately had to undergo a cesarean section to terminate the pregnancy. Lucia's case is unusually disturbing, but abortion advocates say it's all too common for women in Argentina to be denied access to legal abortion. Andrea Lignan, an abortion rights activist, says it starts with the fact that many doctors aren't trained to do the procedure.
So then when they are actually in the hospital and they get to a woman or a woman arrives that needs an abortion, they just don't know what to do.
She says the bigger issue is that many doctors in this majority Catholic country won't perform abortions.
The government allows them to let their religious beliefs interfere with their professional practice when they should be thinking and doing what's best for our health.
Dr. Virginia Braga, who is based in Buenos Aires, says it's true that physicians are allowed to refuse on religious grounds, but they're required to make a referral to another doctor who will provide one. And that's not happening, she says.
Instead of that, they torture women. They ask women to continue the pregnancy. They don't give information.
In January, there was another case of a preteen rape victim in Argentina who was denied an abortion. Braga says in both instances, the girls lived in smaller provinces where attitudes are more conservative.
For a woman who lives in a small town far from the capital city, it will be always very difficult for her to be helped. And of course, it's always worse for poor women.
Last year, a referendum to legalize abortion was narrowly voted down in the Argentine Senate. The activist Andrea Lignan says that defeat has energized anti-abortion lawmakers. She says they've adopted a new symbol and slogan.
They started calling themselves Save Both Lives. They have like this blue handkerchief, light blue handkerchief that they use because ours, the pro-choice, is green. It has always been green. So now they took this light blue color, and then some of them formed a political party last year also so they can run for government.
But Lignan says the Senate vote has also energized abortion rights advocates, and they'll be working hard to elect people who support legalizing abortion, and not just in cases like Lucia's. For The World, I'm Allison Herrera.
New Zealand Today marked 1 week since last Friday's terror attack in Christchurch. Thousands of people gathered at Hagley Park, just steps from one of the two mosques targeted by a gunman. They observed the Muslim call to prayer, which was also broadcast on TV and radio stations all across New Zealand. It's just one of many examples we saw this past week of New Zealanders coming together to remember and honor the 50 people who were killed. Anna Fifield experienced some of that firsthand. She's a Washington Post bureau chief in Beijing. This week, though, she was in New Zealand, in Christchurch, visiting family, which is where we caught up with her. Anna is a native New Zealander and grew up there. I asked her to take us back to when she first found out about the attack.
I was actually on vacation in Thailand when this happened. I'd taken a few days off. But when I saw it coming across my phone screen, of course, I was just glued to it because it was unimaginable that this kind of attack could happen in New Zealand. We've never had this kind of terrorist attack ever before. So as it was unfolding and as I was watching the developments during the day and the death toll kept mounting and mounting, it was just a feeling of kind of shock and disbelief. And at the same time, as a New Zealander and as a journalist, a feeling that I absolutely had to be here to write about this. So The thing that's been really overwhelming in a way is the way that New Zealand has reacted to this. You know, this is not us is the refrain that I keep hearing. And that, that this is not New Zealand and that the country will come together to act on this. And indeed act we have, a mere 6 days after the attacks, the Prime Minister banned all assault weapons and the capacity to turn any kind of rifle into an assault weapon. So it's been very swift and very strong, the reaction.
I mean, the gun rights debate is one we've had in this country, as you know, so many times. For many Americans, it was the speed with which a law banning semi-automatic and assault rifles came about. What surprised you about the debate and how it played out in New Zealand after this attack? I mean, aside from the speed.
Yeah, well, I mean, the speed is the overwhelming, factor here. But the thing that surprised me, I guess, is that even the farmers have said, we don't need semi-automatic weapons for what we use our guns for. And even the conservative opposition party has fully supported this. They're, across the political spectrum, there is only one sitting MP who objected to this very rapid assault weapon ban, and he supports the ban in principle. The thing he objected to was the speed with which this is being rushed through. So there is very, very little disagreement on the need to ban these weapons.
You were speaking earlier about unity, and one symbol of that unity that I've seen that's been really impressive are these many evocations of the dramatic haka dance, this traditional dance by the Maori people. Isn't it an expression of warrior power? How has it been used to honor the victims?
Yeah, I mean, nothing gets me like a haka, you know, especially after all these years away. It's been really beautiful to see that on the streets this week. So yes, traditionally, a haka was the ceremonial dance used in war situations to try and kind of pump people up to feel like unity and strength on one side and to intimidate the other side in a way. And so over the years it's been used in rugby games, for especially against Australia. But in this context, it's only one part of that that has been used. It's this unity and strength and this coming together. So it has been amazing to see these spontaneous haka performed on street corners near the mosque and in the park and all over the place, at schools. When Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern went into Kashmir High School this week, the students did this haka. And everybody does this haka. You see, you know, Pākehā, you know, New Zealanders of European descent, Māori, Samoan, Asian, you know, every kind of New Zealander learns to do this haka. And to see this has been a real sign of unity and power of New Zealand people, I think, to be able to stand up to this kind of thing.
Yeah, that's what I've been feeling when I see them. We've been hearing so much news out of New Zealand this past week, a lot of it really poignant. But is there a story you wish was getting more attention, a story you want to tell?
I think, like you say, New Zealand has had way more coverage this last week than we are used to. You know, usually stories about New Zealand involve an octopus escaping from the aquarium or a sheep on the run. You know, that's what makes the international news. So this is pretty uncomfortable. But I think... I think the sense of tragedy in New Zealand, and the sense that the Muslim community is part of our community, and the way that New Zealand has rallied around this community to support them, I think is something very powerful. So especially to an American, to see this, it must be quite a surprise to see our Prime Minister and the Speaker of the House stand up in Parliament and say,
Assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum, to greet the parliament in Arabic. Also, women around New Zealand are wearing hijab in solidarity with the victims. I even saw a police officer with a huge gun at the funerals protecting them who was wearing hijab this week. So I think the way New Zealand has embraced Islam and adopted Islamic traditions this week has been something that is really remarkable. So I think this is the feeling that I will go away with. You know, I've never been more proud of my country, I think. So I'll go home feeling very homesick at the way we've been able to come together in the face of this terrible tragedy.
Anna Fifield is a native New Zealander based in Beijing now, where she's the bureau chief for the Washington Post. She was speaking with us from Christchurch. Thanks, Anna. Safe travels.
Thank you, Marco.
Let's get back briefly now to the big news today. Special Counsel Robert Mueller has delivered his Russia-Trump report to the Attorney General. Another moment in a two-year series of Friday night news dumps from the Mueller team. We don't yet know what is in Mueller's final report. We also don't know how much of it will be released to the public and when. Here's Senator Chuck Schumer this afternoon.
I think the demand of the public is overwhelming to see the report when it's on such a serious matter, and it will be made public. Public pressure will force it to be.
The first reaction from the White House was true to form. On Twitter, White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders tweeted, "The next steps are up to the Attorney General Barr, and we look forward to the process taking course." The White House has not received or been briefed on the special counsel's report. Earlier, I spoke with investigative journalist Seth Hetina, who had this to say based on what we know now.
You know, Robert Mueller may have declined to prosecute people because he couldn't prove collusion. Now, that means there was insufficient evidence to establish that collusion existed. It doesn't mean it didn't happen.
Final word today goes to President Trump, speaking back in November of 2018.
The witch hunt, as I call it, should never have taken place. It continues to go on. From what I hear, it's ending. And I'm sure it'll be just fine.
It'll all be just fine. As for Mueller himself, his spokesperson said the special counsel will be concluding his service in the coming days. Some staff will remain to close down the office and its operations. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. The World's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. We'll see you back here Monday.
PRI, Public Radio International.